Okay, so I am here with James Marsh, who is most recently the director of Project NIM. James, how are you doing?
Do you want an honest answer?
An honest answer?
No, it's fine.
I'm jet lagged
and a little exhausted.
Uh-huh.
You asked the question. That's
yes,
nice.
I'm sorry about that. Well, we'll hopefully vitalize things. I wanted to start off with the notion that your film suggests that Project NIM arose out of a lingering hippie residue that was settling in the early 1970s. The idea of having a chimpanzee running around a brownstone without any oversight, without any note-taking, without anything along those lines, anybody saying, wait a minute, maybe this isn't the best idea, maybe this chimp might grow up and kill us or something, or might actually hit us, that this was perfectly natural at the time. I'm curious, because the film doesn't really go into this, was there any kind of code of conduct, some ethical oversight, some, you know, scientific rigor going on?
There's definitely scientific rigor, and to be fair to the experiment, you know, I think it comes together in a slightly improvised way in terms of the practicalities of it. And what happens is a professor at Columbia decides he wants to kind of to see if he can teach a chimpanzee to talk, and in this case use sign language. And he puts the chimpanzee with, you know, the first person he thinks of, which is a former student of his and also a former lover of his, who has this kind of household you describe. But Teres's idea is that she does take notes and she does keep a log, but she doesn't want to do any of that stuff.
Yeah.
Because she feels, and it's an important point to make, that this goes against the chimpanzee's nature, which I think she's right about. But it's an experiment and it's a scientific experiment. So you do have this period of time where the science part of it does feel a little bit neglected.
Yeah.
Ethically speaking, I'm not aware of any kind of code of conduct that's in place or any protocols that are in place because, you know, you could argue that the moment you take a creature from its mother, you're doing something that's very, very transgressive.
And yes.
I would think that.
Yes.
Whatever the creature was. And so, you know, from that point on, you've gone against nature. So I don't think you could do the experiment now, let's put it that way. But I think that, to be fair to the professor, he does want to, you know, put it within a scientific tradition. But what he's dealing with is emotions that really can't be, you know, kind of managed that way. If you ask someone to be a creature's mother, then they're going to start looking out for that creature and protecting him from things that she thinks are bad for him. And she thinks that putting on a schedule and taking notes and examining him that way is not good for him.
Yes.
Or good for the language experiment. She feels that his language will emerge much more naturally if he's allowed to kind of run around and be himself. And she may have a point about that.
On the other hand, Professor Herb Teres, who is also, by the way, a student of Skinner.
He's an absolutely direct student.
Yes, exactly. And he also has to be aware of, for example, the Harry Harlow experiment, which was infamous, where you dealt with wire and cloth mothers replacing that. And this is actually not that far.
Well, he mentions that in our interview. We didn't use it in the film eventually, but that's why he put Nim with a human mother.
Mm-hmm.
He felt that if you just put a chimpanzee in a sort of controlled experimental situation, that wouldn't work. So he feels the way that the chimp is going to learn language is by giving him this human environment, this human family, that is going to he'll be conditioned, you know, against his nature to learn language.
Yeah.
And that doesn't work out, as you know.
But. Yes, yes. But, I mean, to a certain degree, you also have images of him getting press coverage. There's the photo moment later on in the film where Nim sees him and then emits this incredible joy at seeing him. And then, of course, we back up and later we see in the next shot there's all these photographers there who are snapping the moment. Certainly a guy who experienced Harlow fairly recently is probably going to be interested in fame and notoriety to some degree. I'm wondering, because he does insist in this film that what he did was science, and yet he's almost unable to look back at some of the more damaging aspects which got into, you know, Nim out of, you know, fear and out of loss of control, actually harming many of the grad students.
Yes, indeed. I mean, again, I wouldn't want to speak for him, but of course I did indeed interview him at great length and am aware of his views on that. And they are what you see in the film, that his view on... he says, you know, I wore blinkers. I didn't want to hear these stories.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean that I don't want to pass a judgment about whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. But his view on the most serious event that happens when Nim is in the experiment, where a young woman gets half of her face bitten off... is that he's worried about the insurance issues about that and not about her personal suffering and the fact that she's a young woman who spends the next year in a certain amount of pain and discomfort. that he does seem indifferent to that, which speaks for itself. I don't need to say anything more about that, really.
Yeah. On the other hand, you actually don't bring up the Washoe Project. Alan Beatrice Gardner and Herb Terrace had a huge rivalry going on at the time with, and it's almost like East Coast, West Coast, Biggie, Tupac almost.
But there's a whole other film to be made about all that stuff. And in fact, there's quite a few PBS-type documentaries that get into the whole language, you know, kind of experiments, the Washoe, the Gardners, and that whole kind of debate. And that would be a film about science, a film about ideas. And our film is a drama about a chimpanzee and people. So I was aware of that context, and many people spoke about it in the course of our interviews, but I didn't. I thought it was going to be a blind alley for me as a filmmaker to get into that too much. Maybe an oversight on my part.
Huh.
But that's a different film. You want to go see that film? You know, someone else can make that. That's not my film.
But don't you have an obligation to present to some degree the history of these animal language?
Why?
Because Washoe ended up having 350 words learning of sign language. Oh, you could just do a brief mention. Yeah.
Well, no. Here's my feeling about that. Yeah. Is a brief mention is not good enough, and that that's when you're playing with it. If you're just going to flirt with something and say, "Well, I can mention Chomsky, and I can mention Washoe and the Gardeners," you'll know about that. But my brother, who's watching the film, won't know anything about that. So I'm not trying to be, you know, I'm being a little defensive here, but that wasn't the film I wanted to make. That's a different kind of film. That film. Go online. Nova has done that film.
Yeah.
Washoe, the fucking dolphins. You know, the Gardeners, the signs, and but the bottom line is that the experiment failed.
Yeah.
And that chimps do not learn language. So I could get caught up in this whole discussion about who was right and who was wrong and who learned the most words. That's not a story. That's a discussion about the practice of science and the nature of these experiments. And so, you know, I wanted to focus on a dramatic story as opposed to the issues and the context. And of course, you know, someone like yourself who's very, you know, familiar with this stuff probably feels a little bit cheated because I don't, you know, explain and give you the context that you are sort of dimly aware of or know a bit about. But that's a very conscious choice on my part not to get caught up in things I can't really fully explain and will be, I think, a sort of sideshow to what I think my interest in the story is, which is an interest about the drama of it and the life story of this chimpanzee. Now, if you're a Nim, what does he fucking care about Washoe and dolphins and the garden? He doesn't know nothing about those things.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to put you in his, you know, his life story is where I'm focused here, not so much on this whole fascinating intellectual climate that, you know, that you're aware of and the film doesn't really get into.
To go ahead and correct your impression that I felt cheated, what I'm actually talking about here is how you as a documentary filmmaker make the choice to not include Washoe. Is it really a consideration of, oh, well, here's a rabbit hole that will create a 3-hour film?
Yeah, or where is my interest in the story, and where do I think the narrative is in the story, as opposed to, you know, I think you could cram the film with reference points to other experiments and to other thinkers and linguists and on, but that isn't the film that I think would work for me as a filmmaker, and the one I'm interested in making.
Yeah.
And so, you know, to kind of distill my view into, I want to tell you the story of this from the point of view of the chimpanzee, who would have no awareness of the other chimpanzee language experiments and no interest in them either, I don't think.
Yeah. So to some degree, it sounds to me that when you make a film, especially one that deals with science, as opposed to, say, an event that numerous people see, such as Men on Wire, your problem, I suppose, is that you were enslaved to narrative to some degree? Is that safe to say?
My interest in narrative. No, I guess I'm a little prickly about this because there's quite a lot of pressure around the making of the film of this sort.
Yes.
Explain more. Mm-hmm. Give me more context. Give me more science. Show me the scientific debate here. And so, you know, I'm prickly about it because it caused me a lot of kind of trouble as I was putting the film together. I kept getting these comments from people, executives involved in the film, that they wanted more of this stuff. And I'm saying, well, you know, they wanted a narrator for the film. And I began to get kind of quite pissed off about this.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't the kind of film that I was making, nor did I ever say I was going to make this film. I'm making the story of Nim the chimp.
Yeah.
And, you know, in a film, films tend to not deal with ideas terribly well. It's not what films are good at doing. I mean, some films do it extraordinarily well, but it's not what they're best for. I think films are best as a medium of storytelling, and so that's what, you know, where my interest is in this particular story again.
Yeah.
Well, this is an interesting dilemma, and to approach it from a technical standpoint, I'm curious when a moment such as a recreation of what's going on in the lab occurs to you. I mean, you have plenty of photos, plenty of film clips in this. When do you need that sort of recreation moment? Does it come because you don't have enough archive footage?
It comes when you have a critical moment in the story that you feel you need to show in some way for the narrative and emotional dimension of it to be available. So, as an example, I shoot the imagery and reconstructions of the film at the very end of the process. So I put it together in a cutting room, you know, to a point where it's almost finished or close to being finished. Then I would go and shoot imagery and reconstructions as where I feel they're needed to tell the story. So it could be as simple as seeing some books lying on the floor, which stands for the poet. And then you see a dog one, you wander through the books and you kind of understand Nim has destroyed the poet. This is going back to the beginning of the story where Nim begins to kind of mess with Stephanie's husband, who's a poet, and his books are very important to him, and he goes and messes with those books. So that story is being told in the film, and I want to see the mess he created, so I'm going to show you the image of that as I see it. Later on in the film, you know, he kills a poodle, and again, I think for that to really resonate, you have to have some sense of what happened.
Yeah.
And so in the film, you know, there's a yapping poodle that appears to be yapping at a chimpanzee, and then you make a cut and you see the aftermath of a very violent poodle murder.
Yeah.
So these are kind of, I guess, trying to, you know, visualize moments of the film that have a value that needs to be visualized, I guess. So that's my thinking about it.
Is there an inherent danger in such a cutting emphasis? Because on one hand, you have to let the audience come away from this film. And you have a story here with loads of detail, so it's very possible, but the audience does have to come away from this film with a certain sense of takeaway and imagination. And on the other hand, there is perhaps the risk of being too explicit.
Too literal, for sure. No, yeah. I mean, that balance, you don't know if you got that right, and it won't always be right for everyone who sees the film. Mm-hmm. Some people might resist the imagery and resist the sort of stylized presentation, and I could understand that and wouldn't argue with that it's a kind of personal reaction. But at the same time, I'm not, sort of the takeaway from the film, I think, is quite complicated. There's not one easy, simple moral here that I'm either offering, or do I think the film offers, or the story offers itself. So, you know, I think that any film like this, you know, what you leave out, what you leave in, how you shoot it, how you don't shoot it, you just do your best, and you have to be comfortable with what you've done for yourself. And if you've pleased yourself, hopefully you please enough people who are going to see the film. That's my kind of bottom line, is have I pleased myself enough in this film?
Let me phrase this question.
Answer my own questions.
Yeah, sure. Let me phrase this another way. If you have to balance the needs of most of the audience coming away with a specific perspective and your own needs to tell a more Baroque narrative through your own particular individual decision to tell a story, I mean, how do you balance that? I mean, you know, you were mentioning earlier a bunch of pressure you were getting from executives. Oh, we need more narration, we need more of this, we need more of that. I mean, you know, what do you give up? That's the question.
Well, I did that, you know, those issues, I resisted them because I knew that I couldn't get into things I wasn't interested in particularly, or I didn't think were particularly relevant to the story that I was trying to tell here. So that's sort of an ongoing debate you're having as you're editing the film too, what you leave out, what you leave in. And but the only person, you know, without sounding self-important, that knows that I'm the person doing all the work here.
Yeah,
I'm. You know, I've spent 2 years of my life trying to tell this story. So one does get a little prickly about someone sitting there and watching the film, an executive telling you what they think they should, what they want to see in the film. Well, go and fucking make it yourself if you have such strong ideas about it.
Yeah.
Certainly, you know, films can be made that way, and they can be made that way where producers have a kind of strong influence on what happens, but I'm not the person that's going to be able to do that, I'm afraid.
Got it. I wanted to also ask you...
Did that answer your question?
Sorry, no, that totally does. I think we solved that particular problem, or that we got an answer there. I was curious about some of the film clips you use, because you're talking to some of these subjects, and some of these subjects, like Stephanie, has the Super 8 clip of Nim wandering around and playing with her kids and the pets and all that. So you have a sort of vague conflict of interest here because you have to get the clip. She's the only one who has the clip. Does this affect your interlocutory approach when you ask her questions? Or what do you do? Do you get the clip beforehand? Do you get the clip after? How does this work?
Well, I think there will be certain events and stories where you might be very careful about the order in which you ask for things. Mm-hmm. In this case, that wasn't ever an issue because, you know, Stephanie, being the kind of person she was, agreed to do the film, agreed to sit down and talk to me, and, you know, told me her story. And I listened to her story and asked her questions about her story. So there was never a kind of issue or pressure to kind of, you know, not be tough on someone or be overly sympathetic because they give me some archive film. That wouldn't be the way I would ever... I'd never recognize that conflict. It would be the best film possible, come what may.
Yeah.
And you do, you know, you do feel a little awkward sometimes when you make a film where people that you personally like very much maybe don't come out of it as well as you're expecting them to or want them to, but you still like them very much on a personal level.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've been a little, you know, sort of guilty about how people have regarded Stephanie in particular, because I think that I don't regard her that way. And you read certain things that people have responded to in her testimony that they... You know, oh, she breastfed the chimp, or she had sexual feelings for him. Well, you know, she's just being honest.
Yeah.
And so in that case, I do feel a little kind of discomfort that perhaps I wasn't clear enough in the film as to what she's about. Although I, you know, truly like and admire her. I think she's an extraordinarily interesting woman. But some people are going to take different things away from her approach to child-rearing, perhaps.
Sure. You've mentioned in Man on Wire interviews that you view some of your documentary subjects much like actors. And this is interesting to me because an actor is preparing or drawing from their, you know, his emotional past, and you're doing this for a sense of pretense on screen. But with a documentary subject, you don't necessarily have that training. And it's also a very direct conduit into their soul. So I'm not sure. I'm curious if you could elaborate on this parallel.
That's not because... what I said, I think, or what I mean by that is that, and all documentary filmmakers should own up to this, is that when you evaluate a story, you do look to cast, you know, people in your story that are relevant to the story, and you evaluate them on the level of how they're going to be on camera and how their characters are going to come across. And you do that, and you might make certain choices. If you had, you know, two people seeing the same, witnessing the same event, and one was, you know, a very, you know, expansive presence, you would definitely choose that person over someone who's reticent and not going to say very much. That would just be the smart thing to do and the right thing to do, I think. When I say they're like actors, that's what I mean. I guess that you make certain choices are based on how someone might appear on camera and how that's going to work in your film. What I meant, I think more broadly, was that I try and create the same situation that I would create for an actor, which is to try and make the circumstances of the work such that they can be and offer what they can offer. So if you're doing an interview with someone, you want to make them feel comfortable, that they trust you, that you're going to listen to them, and you're there to hear what they've got to say. And that's true of an actor, that I would do the same thing in a different way. That I want to make them feel comfortable, you know, in the work they're doing, so they can give me what they want to give me.
Yes,
therein lies the analogy, I think. It's not like I'm wanting my people in my films to kind of perform in a certain way.
Yeah.
But in Man on Wire, you know, Philippe did perform in ways that were only to do with him. Mm-hmm. And I was just there to encourage and capture what he did.
But in certain situations, to get at the truth, isn't a certain amount of discomfort required?
But it can be, yeah. Or you have to, you know, if someone won't answer a question, you have to kind of, you know, keep rephrasing and going at that question. So in the case of Project Nim with Professor Terrace, I was desperately trying to get him to acknowledge that he had an affair with Laura and Petito. And he really didn't want to go there. So I asked him that question in probably 10 different ways.
Yeah.
Gently, directly, indirectly. And he still wouldn't really answer it. He would say we were good scientists, or we had some kind of connection, but he wouldn't talk about having an affair with her. Whereas Laura, of course, had talked about something about this affair. So sure, you do. But generally speaking, I'm not a coercive kind of... I'm not Michael Moore. I'm not going...
Yeah.
I'm doorstepping people and confronting them with their sins and their... You know, that's not... I kind of want to you know, to collude.
Then why should they trust my own purposes? Why should they trust you then?
Well, that's a question for them, really, not for me. But I think not why should they trust me? That you're there to hear their story, and there's a kind of, you know, I guess bargain being made where, you know, you're going to represent their story and give importance and dignity to their story too in some cases. So why people get involved in documentary films is you know an interesting question. You know, what they want from it, what they expect from it. I mean, you look at that film Catfish. That's a very interesting, you know, kind of complicated example of what the woman was about in that film, and what the filmmakers are about.
And which Spurlock insists is a fake documentary as well, along with other people.
Yeah, I mean, I have my views on that film. I think that it's definitely is artificial.
Yeah,
and the circumstances are contrived. The behaviour may not be quite so artificial and contrived, but the circumstances definitely appear to me to be contrived. And I think the sort of the troubling issue of that film is the phony indignation of the filmmakers as to they're being scammed. And I would say that that's not happening.
Yeah,
there's no way that's what's happening. Although them being scammed is only the very starting point for their story.
Sure.
And the scamming is going both ways. Now, it's a very interesting discussion which we could have at great length, and it's one that I'm troubled by sometimes. You know, when you make a film and you say this is the story, and then the story changes because you hear it from other people. It's different, and how you negotiate that can be quite vexing for you on a moral level.
Yeah.
But that's a whole other big interesting discussion, that one.
Yeah, and one unfortunately we're gonna have to have another
indeed,
time.
Indeed, we have to contain it.
But we only just got started. But James, thanks so much.
Thank you. Thanks.